Michelle Pfeiffer.
Michelle Pfeiffer.
Michelle Pfeiffer.
Michelle Pfeiffer.
Well, Mr. Pfeiffer.
Hi, I'm Kira Johnson. I was just wondering if the part-time filing position was still open.
No, it's been filled.
Okay.
Hey, how's your dad going?
Oh, pretty good. You okay?
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Pfeiffer Fridays, where we walk you through the films of one Michelle Pfeiffer, and every F word automatically has a silent P. I'm Jerry Downey.
And I'm Michael McLean.
And today we are covering 2017's Where is Kira, starring Kiefer Sutherland, Suzanne Shepherd, Sam Robards, and La Pfeiffer as the titular Kira Johnson. Michael, we have also already seen this movie before, have we not?
Yes. This was a part of my Michelle deep dive in back in 2019, the famed deep dive. I was trying to think how I heard about this movie because I was living in New York when this came out, when this movie was happening. And I can't remember if I even saw it on like a theater listing in New York, like for one of our indie theaters. Was I keeping track of, films that premiered at Sundance, or I couldn't remember, but somehow I knew to rent it from the library in 2019. So I don't remember how I heard about this.
I'm in the same boat because I remember hearing about this when it was allegedly happening. Because it was a big deal. It was the newest Michelle Pfeiffer movie after a 4-year break.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because The Family was 2013. And it was one of those that kept waiting and waiting. And it was at Sundance. And then we waited. And it was one of those things where, as someone that, follows her career as much as possible, it almost felt like the lost film, because
you really were asking, where is Kira?
Exactly. It's yeah. A very apt title.
Mm-hmm.
Because this one would have premiered theatrically not long after I moved to Chicago, so I wasn't seeing many movies at that point, but even then I felt like I should have seen this somewhere. And yeah, but I was the same as you. It was one of those titles that was always in my head as, I still have not seen this Michelle Pfeiffer movie.
Mm-hmm.
And luckily, exact same story as you, when I did my Michelle deep dive a little over a year ago, this was one of the DVDs I got from my library and got to see it for the first time.
It was, again, another reminder. I think I'd watched this in Age of Innocence and What Lies Beneath. And I think I said in my letterbox review at the time, man, that Michelle is really going places, as a joke, but I felt like there is something different about this performance, I think. And yes, there's something, and maybe it's because she's working with an independent film director. This is really one of the more realistic indie films that we've seen her. It's not, it's not a period piece, it's not a fantasy. This is a very real life story. I don't know if we really get to see her do a lot of these, just extremely true to life narratives. Yeah, it just feels like there's no studio gloss over it.
None. That was something I thought of, because this movie does spend a lot of time in close up on her face. And there's no attempt to frump her ump. This isn't like, a New Year's Eve where they're trying to make her look awkward. It's just sort of natural.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing, especially for the movies that came out in this period as well, there's no attempt to hide her age. It's just, it's going for, as you said, a very real, a very naturalistic effect. And because of that, I kind of feel like this is one of, if not the most transformative roles she's ever had. Not to discount anything else, because I wouldn't say this is my favorite performance of hers. But you kind of, from the get-go, aren't watching Michelle Pfeiffer. Like, there's none of the...
As we would know her, you know, from years ago.
Right. There's none of the bag of tricks that we love from her. And that's not a negative thing. That's the reason we love watching her, for very specific things that she brings to roles. It's very, very different. And it just sort of draws you in and makes you uncomfortable in a way that you don't normally get from a role that she's in. Mm-hmm. And so in that instance, I would say that it is very transformative for her, both physically and in her acting style, which is very impressive this far into her career and for such a small film.
Absolutely. Do you want to tell the listeners a little bit what it's about?
Sure. So we have Keira Johnson, who is divorced and out of work, left her seemingly stable but unhappy life behind in order to come to New York and care for her mother. And right at the top of the movie, her mother passes away, leaving her very much adrift and even more broke than she was to begin with. It becomes very clear that she's trying hard to get a job and no job will take her, mainly due to ageism is what we're shown. Mm-hmm. She develops a relationship with a nursing home worker named Doug, played by Kiefer Sutherland, and they sort of cling on to each other. Mm-hmm. And then she realizes that the only way she can make ends meet is by continuing to cash her mother's social security checks, which has not stopped due to a processing error. Mm-hmm. And so she starts dressing up as her mother and going to cash these checks in order to even attempt to make ends meet. And then the dominoes start to fall, because even though there aren't many people that know her mother, there are just enough for people to see her and realize something is wrong here. And eventually she gets caught, and the movie ends with her being arrested for fraud. Not an uplifting movie.
I know, after these last few weeks of, you know, talking about these fantasy films, comedies, romances, we're really in drama territory.
Yeah, we have done a sharp pivot for this one.
Even you describing the plot back, it's heartbreaking to think to watch a story of somebody driven to one of the most desperate measures I can think of, to lie like this, to put on this really, really dangerous act. You know, it's a crime. And yeah, even watching it last night, it just broke my heart all over again to see her, you know, transform into this woman at the complete, I would say, one of the most lowest points.
And one thing I really liked about some of the interviews that director Andrew Docenmo did about the movie is he was very excited to have Michelle Pfeiffer in this movie, because he thought that because of how established she is and how the general public sort of feels about her, he already had this built-in empathy for this woman.
Mm-hmm.
Because mm-hmm. the public feels like they know her already because she's Michelle Pfeiffer. So you see her and you sort of see your mother, your aunt, your family friend in this situation. But like I said, almost immediately you forget that it is Michelle Pfeiffer.
Mm-hmm.
So you sort of have this subliminal empathy, as he said, built in because of how you feel about Michelle Pfeiffer. And then you watch her go through this. And I think that's very effective and really worked out the way he hoped it would.
Yeah, I think it totally does. I think her introduction is also very different. Than there's no typical Michelle entrance in this movie. I think, because I believe, I don't know if you this is such a small, this opening moment of the old woman walking. There's so many scenes of this in the movie where you see the click of the cane as an elderly woman walks somewhere. She's going somewhere. Do you think that first time we see that woman, is that her mother, or do you think that's her?
That's her.
I think all these scenes, they're all Kira leading up to this.
Yeah, I don't think we ever see her mother walking by herself.
So we have that completely disguised entrance. And then a very beautiful shot. I don't even know what you could kind of splitting the screen of her mother in one room. You see her mother through the doorway, struggling to get out of bed. And then through a mirror reflection, you see Kira drawing a bath for her mother. And we never see her face. We just see her back. She is just there to help her mother and guide her to the bathtub. And then I think maybe the next scene is her doing her roots in the bathroom, but it's in very dim lighting.
Yeah.
And then I think then the next shot is straight on of her face as she's kind of assessing herself in the mirror. And it's almost a very fisheye lens. It's a very, almost like a funhouse mirror look at her. It you don't even know, like, am I even looking at Michelle? It's so dim and dark. Is that even her in there? So it's totally not your typical, not even your typical Michelle swooping in with a fantastic line or a fantastic costume.
No, and truly, if she did not have the relationship she has with Doug, with the Kiefer Sutherland character, this may as well be a silent movie. Yeah. There is so much silence throughout this movie. You're just watching her live. That's the point. And it is very dark, not only in terms of tone, but aside from having her be outside, it's just very darkly lit as well. You rarely ever see her fully. She's always in some sort of shadow, mm-hmm. which again is rather apt for this movie because her character is under a cloud or, you know, has a shadow over her throughout the entire mm-hmm. film. But it's, yeah, it just does a really nice job of evoking all these really bleak feelings without ever saying anything about it. Really, it's all in how the storytelling is done that makes this work.
One of the little connections that I've made, you know, I can only imagine how this kind of intense elder care that I imagine her mother had to go through is so isolating. I had a question, you know, how small had her life become? You know, at the funeral for her mother, there's only a few people there.
Yeah.
I think at one point, I think it's maybe post the funeral, you see her kind of leaning against a wall. And to my mind, her skin tone almost matches the wallpaper behind her. She almost fades into the wall. And later on, I think it's Jack Bauer, Kiefer Sutherland. I was like, Jack Bauer at this bar, when he meets her at the bar for the first time, he says, the way they space designs out, it says, how long have you lived? ? On wherever she lives. But to me, I was like, oh, he's asking, no, the first question is still valid. How long have you lived? Because has she really lived? When her life has been so focused on taking care of her mother and living this very solitary life as a caregiver. And yeah, I think that just speaks to her isolation and how she fades into she seems to fade in a good way. She seems to just fade into the scenery.
And the same thing happens with the wall at that sale where she and Doug are hanging out. There's this really nice scene between the two of them where they're leaning against a wall. And the same thing happens. They're lit almost in a way where they blend into that wall as they're speaking.
Yeah. A very, very interesting technique to do. And I think it speaks to the fact that we're looking at people that we would maybe never think to look at in real life and that we would never maybe give a thought to, or we would maybe glance at them and say, oh no, they're fine. They have their life together. How wrong we can be sometimes and how Yeah, everyone's fighting their own fights.
And that was another interesting thing I saw, is that Andrew Dosenmo wanted to tell a story about the diminishing human values in society.
Mm-hmm.
And most importantly, about how the elderly, or going even further, elderly women are sort of seen as dispensable and invisible, and talk about how even if we do notice them, what we think about them, what their internal lives may be like. And I think he does a really good job of that, because you see people treating Kira with, at minimum, patience in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
But aside from Doug, that's kind of the most kindness she gets. She's thrown away. She's not paid attention to. She's dismissed at almost every job interview she goes to. And yet at the end of the day, she's still expected to be a fully functional human being. And I think that's, this movie does a really nice job of not judging her choices, and in fact showing very naturally and very organically why someone would go to these lengths, because it is actually what they have to do if mm-hmm. they want to keep their apartment. Because interspersed with all of her dressing up and going to cash the checks, she's still hitting the pavement every day.
Yeah.
She's still going to these job interviews. She's still working this shitty job handing out flyers, and it's not working.
Yeah, it feels very much, especially living in New York, I need to maybe Google and see if anybody has ever done this before in any kind of major city where the cost of living is so high. Because I agree with you. Dosenmo doesn't judge Kira for mm-hmm. her decisions. And it does feel like a natural step when you have no other options, when you've exhausted all your options, and when you're still, as she says, when nothing you've worked for is working and everyone has given up on you and you just get so down. And to me, it never stretches the bounds of plausibility. I always think, okay, yeah, this is, what would I have done in this situation?
Yeah.
If it was my mother, you know, my mom, when she was taking care of her mother there at the end, luckily my mother had other family to help her out. And she was, I think grandma left behind money that, you know, paid for her funeral expenses. And we had it all together to take care of that. But I kept on wondering, you know, what if mom was in Kira's position? If it was just her and she was that isolated, you know, what would she have done?
Well, especially because you see there's that really sweet scene with her and her mom where her mom kind of coaxes her into getting her some booze. So you see this very, very loving relationship between the two of them, but also something that really strikes as codependent because they seem to be all that each other has.
Yeah.
And so it's one of those things where you sort of feel that, who knows if her mother would have even survived as long as she has without Kira being there to help. And by the same token, if her mother didn't have this apartment, Kira would probably be homeless at this point.
Mm-hmm.
So it's one of those things where you see them really teetering on this cliff, but making it work. And then it teeters the wrong way when the mom passes, and now everything is thrown out of balance.
Mm-hmm.
And what do you do in that situation where, you know, there are so many movies out there where they could have framed, you know, this passing as a release and something to grow on. You know, we've seen those where it's, you know, starting a new chapter. But with Kira, there's no new chapter to start. She's got to stick with the same book. And hope to God she makes it work. And that's what makes it so bleak, is there's no starting from scratch for her at this point, as she seems to think.
Oh, that breaks my heart that there's no new chapter to start.
Yeah.
That's, yeah. I gotta sit with that one for a second.
there's a lot to process watching this movie. And I think that really does speak to how effective it is. It really does make you ask a lot of questions about a lot of things.
You know, what would you have done if you were dating? You know, when I was watching the scene where Doug finds out that she's been posing as her mother, because Doug eventually then gets roped into helping her continue the scheme. Would you have cut ties with somebody if you knew that they were doing this in their life? It's hard to even think of like what I would have done in that situation.
See, and I think I would have had to. Yeah. But it's so difficult to answer that question in the perspective of this movie, because you totally understand Doug saying, no, I will not be party to this. But you're already so invested in Kira as a character and hoping that she lands on her feet that you want him to help. And you do believe her when she says, I won't do it again. Because again, she's not just, you know, waiting each week or each month just to dress up and go cash a check. She is trying. Mm-hmm. So you do want to believe that when she says, okay, that was my last time, because it should have been if somebody caught her. She's lucky that that's the person that caught her first, mm-hmm. instead of somebody else. So that should have been where it ended, but it's not.
And in a way, speaking with the codependency of Kira and Ruth, her mother, those feelings seem to move then on to Doug, because he is her neighbor. They find they connect. They're in the same type of lonely boat. In a way, they're all each other has then, because Doug's life seems not so amazing either. So I understand, you know, the throwing caution to the wind and just wanting to be with this person that you connect with. And so even to me, it makes sense that he would join in on her scheme just for the love of her and to help her and see it as maybe one of the only options.
Well, and especially because Doug really only steps in to help when the police become involved.
Mm-hmm.
He steps in to help because he doesn't want her to go to jail.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, kind of be a protector if he can.
Yeah. So in that instance, because it has already gone so far and there's that tiny little glimmer of hope that if they can just get through this police interview, this nightmare will be over.
Yeah.
I understand his actions at that time. It's like, get the police in, get him out, and this ends today.
An image that I have that stuck with me the most from this is before Doug finds out, and when they're at a kind of a little bar together, and he mentions, you know, I could have sworn I saw your mother on the street today. And what did I write down here? I wrote a one word. I said, panic, terror, dread, fear. Everything on her face. It's one of the best kind of Michelle Pfeiffer face performances in this movie. Because you have to read so much through her face in this, because her lines are kind of few and far between. But yeah, that look, I had to rewind that because I wanted to watch every section of that response.
Yeah, I made the same note. I literally wrote down the reaction to Doug seeing her equals perfect.
And even the way that it's shot, I call it like the persona portrait of Lady on Fire, where it's like, have profile of one person's face and then you see the full side of another person's face. Not sure what that shot's called, but
the persona shot.
Yeah, the persona shot. And I think it's even used a little bit on the poster for the film.
It is. Yeah.
But yeah, it's oh man, that's a good, beautiful, perfect reaction. Perfect acting in my mind.
Yeah. This sounds so silly to say because it sounds so general, but you really get to see Michelle act in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't mean that she doesn't in other movies. My God, this is episode what, 37?
Yeah.
You know how we feel about this by this point. But it's just a very merciless view of this character. And it asks a lot of her in terms of just keeping the camera planted on her, giving her no dialogue, and asking her to assist in telling this story.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something we have not seen from her in many films, that asks her to sort of settle into the silence of a character for that long a period of time,
mm-hmm.
and achieve it to the effect that she does.
That's probably what you mean. It's when you mean when you say it's so transformative. We haven't gotten to see her sit in silence like this.
Yeah.
And even with, I think I, with the panic, terror, dread, fear, I also made a note of it with when she loses her mom's wallet. And I maybe that section of the film when she's running all over town trying to find this wallet, I can maybe think of it similarly with this, with the scenes of when she's in her old lady getup and she's walking to the bank, and you have this extremely discordant score around her, percussive clicks of the cane. To me, it's almost like horror film beats in a way. I don't know how else to describe it. I mean, just it may be kind of terror beats, you know. If she loses that wallet, she can't go to the bank and prove that she is who she says she is. Yes. And if imagine every time she walks to that bank, you know, what if this is the one day that I get caught? You know, what if I mess up today? Yeah, I wouldn't really say they're horror beats, it's beats of terror, because so much is at stake.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. The score is very, not much of the movie is scored, but when it is, it does feel a little bit like a horror movie score. Mm-hmm. You're spot on with that.
I'd forgotten about the losing the wallet scene. When I think you see her digging in her bags for something, I was like, what did she leave? I can't remember what it is that's missing. I was like, did she lose the wig? Did she lose that? You know, what's... And then once you realize that, oh my God, she's going to have to, because yeah, the wallet's gone, presumably, and she's going to have to go get a new ID, and just the, you know, she has to keep the glass. She can't keep the glass. She can't keep the hat on. Then she goes to the DMV to get the picture taken. And her face might as well be the face of like a skeleton almost. It's just so, it's so grim.
Well, and that's the one thing about this movie is you know the dominoes are going to fall. Eventually, mm-hmm. you just feel it.
Mm-hmm.
And the second the wallet gets lost, somebody's pushed the dominoes. And from then on, it's just watching them fall for the last 30 minutes. And I'm thinking of things like when that one very pleasant bank manager greets her as her mother. And what's funny is there's so much of this movie that keeps it at a remove and it works. Mm-hmm. And that's one of those scenes where you are so far away, you can't even really see the facial expressions of the bank manager, meaning you sure as hell can't see her in her scarf and her hat and her glasses. You can't see her face and what she's thinking, but you see the pace of her body start to pick up, and you can just tell from her body movement that she's like, do I answer him? Can I go faster? How the fuck do I get out of this bank as quickly as possible and not blow my cover?
Mm-hmm.
And that's impressive.
Yeah.
That you just can see how she's responding without seeing any of her face.
The physicality of when she is in her disguise is really, I'd never seen her do anything like that before. I can't think of anything, and I can't think of another performance that makes her do this. Maybe Catwoman in terms of physicality, but it's so impressive that I question even, you know, is it her under there? Is she even doing that? Because it's so committed.
Yes.
And when you think about it as her character, you know, how long is that walk taking her to get to the bank every day? If she's maintaining that pace, you know, that's just so, just even in terms of what Kira decided to do, that's impressive, you know, to keep this act up.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's amazing that you can tell immediately from far away, yeah, where she's at in this moment. Even when she's a trying to catch the bus, she's running a little bit faster. Yeah. You know, when she thinks someone's, when she thinks Doug has spotted her, it's, oh shit, I gotta turn around, you know, but I think he's already seen me, I'm already caught. Yeah, it's such a good point, because you can just, even from so far away, she's able to convey through this hunched body language the process.
Do you have a favorite Michelle moment in this movie, or one that's that stuck out to you this time around?
Maybe it is towards the end, like the last 10 minutes. At least I'd forgotten about the end. I remember the ending shot of the film. I, for some reason, I had got it mixed up a little bit with some images from What Lies Beneath. Her eyes in the bathtub, for some reason, had like, I had like superimposed the image of just her darting eyes onto like her in the police car. Like I knew like the ending of the film was her kind of being arrested and her in a police car, but for some reason I thought her eyes were more prominent.
Gotcha.
In the way they are in that last shot, but I had a whole other idea of what the last few minutes would be. But I think it's the, I'd forgotten how the ending panned out. And the moment when the detective, you know, says, why is Kira's ID in your mother's wallet? Do you recognize this grave? And kind of the full body jerk that she has towards Doug, yeah, is very, is so unexpected, was so unexpected to me, but yet so perfect, because in that moment when the jig is fully up, it's like, it's fight or flight. It's, you know, what the fuck is happening? What's going on?
And that scene doesn't start out tense.
No.
But by the time, the second they start speaking to her, you are fully aware that they know.
Mm-hmm.
And for some reason, the way it's directed and the way it's scripted and the way it's acted, just millimeter by millimeter ratchets up this tension without you realizing it. So by the time they do that, like the ID and what you're saying, you are sitting on the edge of your seat because you know this can't end well.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't realize that you've been on the edge of your seat for the past 2 minutes. But it's, yeah, that scene gets under your skin real deep without you realizing it.
And the film does an amazing job of showing incrementally how much of her life she's had to peel away to make this work. You know, there are certain shots of when you see her in bed, in her bedroom, and you see, oh, the dresser's gone. Oh, this is gone. So is this. Even realize that her heat even turned on. You see her get into bed and you see a little puff of cold air come out of her mouth to show us, oh, her heat must be turned off. When the cops come, you've seen so many shots of the living room, unnerving shots that kind of zoom into the living space. But at the beginning of the film, we saw it fully populated with furniture and pictures and everything. And then at the very final scene, when the detectives come to interrogate Kira, there's a lamp on the floor. There's just pictures on propped up against the wall. I think there's a chair. I don't know if there's even a table. Luckily, we don't see that. We don't see like a selling montage, but it's much more effective to see, just, you know, compared to what we saw earlier in the film, look at her now. I think if I were the detective, I would have gone in and been like, well, obviously something is up here. And yeah, I think that moment, I was on the edge of my seat. I think I was waiting. My roommates were on their way home from being out last night. And I was praying that they wouldn't come home, because I was like, no, I have to, I was glued to the screen. I did that scene. I was like, I hope nobody comes in and interrupts this. I hope Turbo just sits on the couch and doesn't want to do anything. Like I forgot how white knuckle this is.
Yeah. And sort of circling back to what we were talking about, I think it's because of how heavily it invests you in her.
Mm-hmm.
And not only in her character, but wanting her to land on her feet despite all these things that she's had to do.
Mm-hmm.
And watching this scene, you just inherently know it's a tragedy. Like, this can't end well, and not even well, this is going to end as badly as it can.
Do you have a favorite Michelle moment?
This time around, it was a scene that I had actually completely forgotten about, which is the scene where she goes to ask her ex-husband for money.
Yeah, I was hoping that was going to be yours because I wanted to talk about that one.
Yeah. I had completely forgotten that scene existed.
Yeah.
And that camera stays on her for what feels like 5 minutes, and not a whole body shot, just her face. And I thought it was such a different turnaround because it comes not long after Doug breaks it off with her the first time. Mm-hmm. And she had had this really great scene where really it's the only time we see her character angry.
Yeah.
In the movie is when Doug confronts her about impersonating her mother, and she loses it on him. And I think it's part of the fact that that deception is gone and she doesn't have to play nice anymore because all the secrets are there that just sort of allow her to be like, you want to know why? Because my life fucking sucks. Mm-hmm. And I have this stack of bills and I'm doing everything I can. But then you pivot to this scene with her ex-husband who doesn't know everything she's going through and who she is there only to ask for money. And you just see her simmering for this entire scene. And you know that she wants to haul off and lose her mind. And she doesn't. It's completely internalized. She's trying to be very nice about, oh, you know, you painted the walls and you're pregnant. How wonderful. I need money.
Yeah.
And she just sort of has this stream of consciousness monologue about, you know, everything she's trying to do, and she'll pay him back. And the camera just sits on her and lets her do this masterclass for this 5 minutes. And that's the one that stuck with me most, because it, again, in another movie, this could have been, you know, some big Oscar clip, things being thrown, rage-filled monstrosity. And it's not. And even the slight hints that it could go there, she pulls back because she knows that if she doesn't get money from this guy, can only go further downhill more quickly. So yeah, that's the one that I remember most this time.
That gut punch of a line when she says, I've resorted to even handing out flyers and praying every day that I even have that, gets you right there.
Yeah.
That is a wonderful scene. I'm glad you brought that one up. Another little itty bitty moment. It's when she applies for the job at that restaurant. And when she goes back to check in, the manager says, you know, oh, I tried to call you yesterday. And Kira's like, oh, my phone broke. You know, her phone line was cut off. And you realize that, you know, the position's already been filled. They've gone to the next person on the list. And as Michelle is about to leave in just full dejection, she glances at that young waitress. And it speaks that kind of ageism comment that you made about how this movie does, how the film looks at elderly women and how they are perceived in society. And yeah, just that little, I had to rewind it to make sure I didn't miss it. But yeah, no, Michelle fully clocks that young girl. And it's almost like she's okay, this is how it's going to be.
Yeah, that's one of the more heartbreaking tics of both the script and her performance, is how pleasant she remains in all of those job interviews, despite, again, being dismissed out of hand at most of them, or just being told flat out, oh no, that job's already been filled. And she always sort of just gets this weary smile on her face and says, thank you. There's one that, for some reason, the way she said it just broke my heart, because again, you know that it wouldn't work whether she did or not. But she was just like, do you mind if I just come back here and check in with you periodically? And the guy says yes, but you see on her face that she's just like, who knows if this would even pan out. But yeah, you're just watching her do literally everything she possibly can.
The lines she does have, you know, they cover up such, you know, such desperation and sorrow. You know, I think at the funeral, her ex-husband comes up to her and says, how are you? They're checking with each other. And she says, yeah, I'm up for a few things. I'm doing okay. I'm doing fine. You know, classic responses.
Yeah.
That, you know, you are not doing fine. You are not up for a couple of things. You can barely get by. The script is really very tuned in to the ways that we cover up any of our personal issues to just skate by in polite society. Begs you to look a little deeper next time maybe somebody says, you know, how are you? And, you know.
And that was one thing I did think about is, I think it's at the tail end of her blowing up at Kiefer Sutherland. They're sitting on her bed together. And all he can really offer her is, we'll get through this. It will get better. And you can just tell by how she's responding to that, that it's one of those moments where that is the worst thing you can say to me,
mm-hmm.
is that this will get better. I need you to tell me that this sucks right now, or just not say anything at all, but don't tell me this is going to get better. I think the only thing that I again noticed more so with the second watch is how long some of the scenes are, especially how long they are with very few cuts in them. Mm-hmm. And the one that stuck out to me is when she finds her mom dead on the couch. That scene lasts for an uncomfortable amount of time.
Yeah.
Where you see her find her mother, kind of push her shoulder to make sure. And then the camera, again, the only cut it makes is to a closer view of Kira. And you just watch her process this essentially with no words and eventually sit on the chair sort of wondering what she's supposed to do in this instance. And it really does make you sit with this character for a long amount of time. It's not just little snippets of her life. And I think, again, that's what sort of evokes this empathetic response to her as you watch her process so much of this. But there are plenty of other scenes like that that last longer than you would expect them to, in a good way, I should say.
Yeah, and once, especially that scene, I remember thinking, because I can't remember if I remembered that she does dress up as her mother to cash these checks. My memory was a little bit foggy of the details surrounding her mother. And so that scene, as that really long extended scene, we're thinking, she's gonna call the cops, right? Is she going to hide the body? No, she can't, because the body would smell. Like, is that her thought process? You know, can I call the police? Can I afford an ambulance to take her to where she needs to go? You would do have to sit in Kira's head and ask yourself these questions. You know, what do I do? Where should I even do something with this body right now?
So sort of moving into the making of this movie, this was shot in 18 days, which fuck yes.
Yeah, girl.
Good. You did that. That's amazing. Shot on location around New York in 18 days. The original title was Beat Up Little Seagull. And then they scrapped that and landed on Where's Kira? And then we sort of get into this limbo,
mm-hmm.
with the movie, which, kind of like we talked about with personal effects,
mm-hmm.
although I don't necessarily know if at this point in his career you could say Kiefer Sutherland was as big as Ashton Kutcher was at that point, maybe. Like, we're pretty far after 24 by this point. But still, you've got another sort of return of Michelle Pfeiffer at this point, 4 years later, in an indie movie. that performs very well at Sundance, gets a good response there. And then nothing.
Yeah, it's surprising to say that not really other, no other really film festivals picked it up, did they?
No, they did. So Sundance was in January of 2017. That's where it premiered. They did BAM in June and Philly in October. Did a UK one that year as well. So, you know, very spread out, basically almost just shopping it around, trying to find a distributor. And then they finally land on a distributor in February of 18. So over a year after Sundance is when they finally got a distributor for the movie.
Yeah.
And then the reason why you may not have noticed it in theaters is because it really was only in theaters for a week. Like if you look at Box Office Mojo, it was out in theaters on, it was on screens for a month, but April 6, 2018 is when it was theatrically released and it was on one screen. The next week was its biggest release week on 33. The following week it was on 12 screens. And then the week after that it was at 8 and then it was gone. So basically it just ran for the entire month of April, really just the second week of April on 33 screens and then done.
Which is such a shame because you would think with two, even if the director is maybe not as well known, you have these two stars that could really help sell it. But was it the story? Was it because they couldn't, in terms of marketing the film? I'm sure this was a difficult one to market, get people out there to go see. I feel like the concept is kind of best that you don't know much about going into it. So then how do you promote something this bleak that relies on a pretty spoiler-free experience as well? Like,
it almost feels like nobody tried.
True.
On the marketing front, which is the sad thing, because this was, I mean, ostensibly kind of a passion project of Michelle's, because this was really the first indie movie she'd ever done. She's a studio queen, for lack of a better word. But she had seen Andrew Dawson Moe's previous film and really loved it. And so when they got together about this one, it was just like, yes, absolutely, let's do this. And especially considering that this was the one that brought her back out of another four-year retirement for an indie movie.
Yeah,
that's got to be a big deal for her. And
up in the release of Mother as well, with the notices that she got.
Right. And that's the thing. You had Whereas Kira should have come first, kicking everything off, but then it just launched at Sundance. She had three other movies come out before Kira was released theatrically, which is insane.
This, to my mind, should have been, you know, at the top of that list of releases to watch out for her in, instead of just, you know, a drop in the release bucket, like the post-Oscar release bucket where nothing really much is coming out in the spring in terms of big, flashy, auteur, awards buzzy projects.
Yes. It's just so weird to see the ball get fumbled on a movie like this, because this feels like one of those very quiet, female-led films that could have really gained steam toward her being an awards player for this. And even if it was just her sort of carrying the torch, even if the direction of the film itself didn't get noticed, even though I think they're both good enough to where they could have at indie awards shows at the very least.
Yeah, I'm amazed that it didn't even show up at the Independent Spirits, you know, or any kind of...
Ah, that for me is the clearest barometer that the studio fumbled this movie hard, because this performance from Michelle Pfeiffer it is tailored to being noticed at the Indie Spirits.
Did you ever see that the Mary Kay Place film Diane a few years ago?
No, but I want to.
You know, that had a very similar trajectory to this. But even Diane, that got the Independent Spirit Awards found that one.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think in this case, it really is a fumble on terms of the marketing and for really getting that film out there for people to see. Because I'm sure if people had, they would have absolutely scooped it up and known it as for what it was, this really little indie gem.
Yeah, we've seen enough of those because mm-hmm. even, I feel like even if this had gotten a proper kick, there's a good possibility she could have got into the Golden Globes drama
mm-hmm.
lineup this year. As we know, the Golden Globes love them some Michelle.
Mm-hmm.
And she, I think it would have been a follow-up to her getting back at the Golden Globes for Wizard of Lies.
Mm-hmm.
So it's almost like you wonder, did this studio just not know what they had? Did they just think, oh, this has been shopped around for a year, so this must be a nothing, we can treat it
as such?
It's frustrating because the only thing I will say is that the Gotham Indies, which are as big an independent film as the Indie Spirit Awards, they are the ones that noticed her because she only got nominated at three places. It was the American Film Awards nominated her, seven nominees, one of which was Michelle, and she lost in a tie to Maggie Gyllenhaal in The Kindergarten Teacher and Rosamund Pike in A Private War.
Okay.
And then as much as I would love to say the Indiana film critics noticed her because they did nominate her, when you look at that list, they nominated like 15 people. So that's one of those that, glad she broke into the pack, but they basically nominated everybody.
Kind of leading actress in that year.
But you at least get to the Gotham Indies, which only nominated five actresses that year, one of which was her, as it should be. She lost to Toni Collette in Hereditary,
mm-hmm.
was up there with Glenn Close for The Wife, who was, let's be real, the real indie darling of that season. Sure. Catherine Hahn for Private Life and Regina Hall for Support the Girls. So that was sort of the biggest traction that was found for her in this movie was the Gotham Indies, because the Indie Spirits, Glenn Close wound up winning that, and then you also had a repeat of Toni Collette, Regina Hall, Elsie Fisher for Eighth Grade, Carey Mulligan for Wildlife, and then Helena Howard for Madeline's Madeline.
You know, as much as I am really not a fan of The Wife as a film, I really don't like that movie. I think Glenn is fine in that movie. She's the one that I would scrap to then maybe put Michelle in, because every other performance I think is so deserving. I think I'd maybe give, Toni Collette was nominated.
Yes. So
I'd probably given her the win, or maybe Carey Mulligan for Wildlife, maybe even Regina Hall, I don't know. But I think out of all those nominees, I would have just unfortunately cut Glenn and maybe put in Michelle.
I'm with you on The Wife. If you go back and listen to Dangerous Liaisons, you know the two of us love us some Glenn Close. But The Wife didn't do it for me like I wanted it to, as a movie especially.
There's some moments she hits in that movie where I'm like, great, good job, Glenn, but it's a no for me, dog. I think that if we could have gotten Michelle in there, that would have been a pretty unimpeachable Indie Spirit Best Leading Female category.
I am curious, just, you know, to probably go further into revisionist history than we have in quite a while. I am curious, just thinking about, okay, she got the Indie Spirit and that started some sort of actual campaign, because the vicious cycle is the studio has to actually campaign her for her to get a nomination. You can't just get a nomination and then the studio go, oh, well, maybe we should like put money behind this. But if that leads to a Golden Globe drama nomination, you have Glenn Close winning once again. You got the Lady Gaga for Star is Born, Melissa McCarthy for Can You Ever Forgive Me, mm-hmm. Nicole Kidman for Destroyer, and Rosamund Pike for Private War. I haven't seen Private War.
I keep Rosamund Pike in the category.
See, and I feel like despite the Globe's love of Nicole Kidman as well, I feel like Michelle Pfeiffer for that performance could have got in over Kidman or Pike.
I think, yeah, depending on where the love was in that, I bet the love would have stayed for Nicole, and then probably Michelle would have taken Rosamund's spot. I just feel like the Globes are really, although not, yeah, they have been lately. Even though Nicole hasn't had a strong showing for The Undoing with a lot of awards, I think she was nominated for a Golden Globe.
She was.
The Undoing. So I think she was going to be there. So I think, yeah, it was probably going to be Rosamund's spot. And I wouldn't have wanted her to, because Rosamund is actually very good in A Private War. I remember her being a very good, very good performance. I was so pleased that she got nominated. But yeah, I probably, if I were a voting woman, I would have put her in. I mean, right now, I don't want to be a member of the HFPA, but
no one does.
No. So, but if I were a member of the HFPA in 2018, I probably would have voted for her over Kidman.
Let's see, if 2018 was Coleman, who's our 2017? That would have been Francis.
Yeah,
Francis's third or second.
Yeah.
Okay, so if this got picked up right after Sundance and was a 2017 release, do we think she might have fared better in that lineup? So we're talking, what, McDormand, Ronan for Lady Bird, Robbie for Itania, Hawkins for Shape of Water, and Meryl for The Post. Another just really sort of unimpeachable lineup, unfortunately.
Because that's the one Meryl nomination of late that I'm like, yeah, she can have that one.
She absolutely can have that one for The Post.
I can't really think to take any of them out.
This is the Michelle curse we come up against more often than not, which in no way takes away the fact that this is an exceptional performance from her on a lot of fronts.
Yeah, I wish it had been able to find its way in. I think maybe if it had even been released just in conjunction with Mother, you know, maybe Mother, I think that was a September 2017 release.
Yeah.
We would maybe put out Where is Kira, you know, in December. Those wonderful indie slots, maybe around Thanksgiving, December. I think the notices that she got for Mother could have just rolled into this goodwill from Where is Kira, and probably could have, I think, gotten her that Globe and Spirit nomination. Don't know if she would have cracked the Oscar race with this one for that year. There were so many that year that wanted to crack through that didn't. So I feel like she'd have been maybe with
7th or 8th.
Well, maybe right out there with Emily Blunt.
Who I think was the 6th spot that year.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, it is kind of the Michelle curse, isn't it? Where she always seems to be just on the outside.
So our ever popular question, would you recommend this movie?
Yeah, for sure. I think it's, it feels like one of those, if you know, you know, kind of movies where it's like, oh, you love Michelle. Have you seen Where is Kira? And you're like, and when you can say, yes, I have seen, like, okay, cool. Then we can talk about Michelle.
you're part of the club.
Yeah. It's like the password to get into the, you know, have you seen Where is Kira? Yeah, I was even talking to a friend of the pod, Corey Ryan, my roommate. I just wanted to tell him that I just watched it. He's like, I never heard of it. I'm like, oh, Corey, it's one of her best ones. He's like, really? I'm like, yeah.
Yeah.
So I think it's our duty as the Michelle Pfeiffer podcast, and our duty is to spread the Michelle gospel. You know, please watch Where is Kira? It is the, if we're going to have maybe a 10 Pfeiffer commandments, you know, one of them would be watch Where is Kira.
No, I agree. I would definitely recommend this one. Make sure you're in the mood to fall into a movie.
Yeah,
like don't
put a good like couple hours for yourself.
Yeah, don't get off a bad day of work and decide that that's the time to put this one on, because you probably won't won't appreciate it for what it is, but.
This made me feel dejected about any job search I have in the future. Oh boy.
It is well worth watching for a variety of reasons, chief among them being that it's a really great Michelle performance.
Yeah. Anything else before we move on to 6 degrees?
I don't think so. I think that's all I got for this one.
I think it, do you want, I think it's your turn to do the 6 degrees intro.
Okay. So listeners, if you were joining us for the first time, we end every episode with a little game we like to call 6 degrees of Michelle Pfeiffer. And that is where we give each other an actor or actress and have to connect them back to Michelle Pfeiffer via other actors or actresses in 6 degrees or less. Michael, do you want to give or receive first?
I'll give first.
Okay.
So yours today is another Queen.
It's my bite plate is a ski.
It's a Sharon Stone.
Oh, Sharon. So I've got an easy one for that one.
Okay.
Because isn't good old Bobby D is in Casino with Sharon Stone, right?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, that's right.
And he's in both Stardust and our favorite, The Family, with Michelle Pfeiffer.
Don't forget about The Wizard of Lies, Bernie Madoff himself.
And though they're never on screen, yeah. New Year's Eve.
Yeah.
So many paths to the Bobby D of it all.
Yes.
So I went back a little ways for you, and I am giving you Agnes Moorehead.
Okay.
She was one of my witch choices that we never got through in our magical Michelle.
Okay. Let's see.
Which we got dragged. Did you see?
We did. We got dragged.
We got dragged. Quote unquote dragged.
But who dragged us?
On Twitter, because both of us forgot that Miranda Otto is in What Lies Beneath. Remember the 90 seconds Miranda Otto was in What Lies Beneath?
Oh, yes. Well, to be fair, does Miranda Otto remember that she was in that movie?
I'm going to go with no.
So
it doesn't change the fact.
True. I mean, there have been so many people that have gone back. I mean, we've talked about this so many times when we give us these people. We're like, oh, yeah, why could I not think of that person? He's been in 5 Michelle movies. Like,
and usually I'll even do like a cursory look up like Michelle Pfeiffer plus this person just to make sure I haven't forgotten something. Mm-hmm. Did not do that for Miranda Otto. I was just like, Miranda Otto hasn't been in a Michelle Pfeiffer movie. This should be fine.
This is easy. Sure, it'd be real easy. it's using, I think I'm gonna have to use a Bobby D connection too. I hope Agnes Moorehead is in Hush Hush Sweet Charlotte, isn't she?
She sure as hell is.
Honey, she sure is. She's in that with Olivia de Havilland, who is in Gone with the Wind with Vivien Leigh, who is in A Streetcar Named Desire with Marlon Brando. No, but he wasn't in The Godfather with Marlon Brando. He was in The Godfather Part 2. So, oh, no, well, who was in? I just wanted Olivia de Havilland, Vivien Leigh, Marlon Brando, who was in The Godfather with Al Pacino, who was in Frankie and Johnny, Scarface.
Yes.
With Michelle.
Very nice.
We got there.
When you said Gone with the Wind, I was just like, Michael, we're going in the wrong direction.
That's what I was like. I was like, every time I think of like Gone with the Wind, I'm like, no, we're going even further back. We can't go back. We have to go forward.
Good. Like, well played.
Bobby D is in, he begins his Godfather journey in part 2, not the first one.
That was well done. I'm proud of you.
Thank you. I thought for sure it was going to be the one time when I couldn't get it in 6. I thought, that's my mind when I was like, oh no, is this going to be the first time I have to do it in 7 or 8? Oh my God, this has never happened. This will be a monumental day.
We are now playing 8 degrees of Michelle Pfeiffer.
10 degrees of Michelle Pfeiffer.
Next week, I'm going to give you like Louise Rainer or something and just really see how many connections we need to do.
Isn't that the first Oscar winner for Best Actress? Wasn't that one of the first ones?
First one to win back-to-back.
Can you imagine? Just go from like the very beginning of like.
I know. Just be like, Michael, I need you to connect Michelle Pfeiffer to Mary Pickford in Six People or Less.
Number one.
It's like we start the next episode with you still connecting people.
Oh my God. It's like Jacqueline Bisset in Golden Globe speech where she's still thanking people. To this day, she's still thanking people.
Well, on that note, Pfeiffer fans, this has been another episode of Pfeiffer Fridays. I'm Jerry Downey, and you can follow me on Twitter at JerryDowney913 or on Letterboxd at the same name.
And I'm Michael McLean, and you can follow me on Twitter, Instagram, and Letterboxd at Michael D. McLean.
You can find updates about the podcast by following us on Twitter and Instagram at Pfeiffer Fridays. Please remember to subscribe, rate, and review us on Apple Podcasts or whatever your preferred podcast subscription channel is. It makes us easier to find so we can continue to spread the Michelle gospel to one and all. Thank you for joining us, and we will see you again next week for Pfeiffer Fridays.
I mean, you know how hard I've worked, and it wasn't my fault that, you know, they downsized me out of a job.
That was 2 years ago.
And ever since then, I have been looking every day. I don't even know how many resumes I've dropped off.
There are other jobs, you know.
I know that. I have tried everything. And am reduced to handing out flyers on parked cars. And praying every day that I even have that.